Oh, boom now, huh? All right, Brad. Very pro. Very pro. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm going to LA tomorrow.
Oh, no. What's happening? Big meetings?
Kids have a few days off from school, so we're just flying out to hang with the cousins just to get...
Just hopping out to LA.
That's the way we roll, baby. You're getting on the private jet.
Yeah, of course. Do you have like a special set of like sunglasses and wristbands you wear just to go out to LA?
My LA shades. Yeah.
What kind of flyer are you? Are you like sweatpants and sandals flyer, or do you keep it together?
No way. I think that's fucking disgusting.
It is. I know.
The give up cult, the surrender culture, I can't get behind it. I mean, yeah. I think it's funny that like when I was a kid, you know, like a little kid, like, you know, you dressed up to go on a plane.
Right.
You know, like literally you dressed in your best clothes.
Yeah. People wear suits back in the day, right?
And I'm not that guy, but like, if I feel like I should look presentable. But
do you feel as the head statesman of your family, you have to, hello, I am speaking for these little people and I wear a shirt with buttons on it. I get it. Yeah, I get it.
I
do not like if it's not an overnight flight and you're fucking coming on with like neck pillows and open toed shoes and sweats and all that. I'm like, yo, you're going to Florida, motherfucker. Like read one chapter of a book and you're there.
Yeah.
Like, one drink, one chapter. Like, you don't have to look like a fucking refugee camp here. Like,
you ride in your car more than for longer than what you're taking the flight for.
Yes.
It's
always strange when I see that.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I wear comfortable clothes. I mean, I was, especially during the rubber track. Well, yeah, during rubber tracks, I was traveling a lot. So I learned how to like, you know, comfy shoes and pants that look good, but they were like, they weren't going to bind, you know, and
you know
jacket. I had the best flying jacket that I left on a plane to London. And still, it's like one of those things that to this day, I still lament that jacket. I shouldn't even describe it. It was just whatever. It was a cool looking jacket, but you could like kind of just ball it up and use it as a pillow and unball it. It looked great. Oh, I missed that jacket.
My whole thing is like, I think when I'm on a plane, I'm not totally comfortable. Like,
oh yeah, you're never comfortable.
There's a part of me that's like defensive element. At any second, I'm going to have to like do something crazy. I'm here. I'm going to have to fucking tackle that guy who goes crazy. I'm going to have to assist in a crash landing. Like that's always in my head. And I'm like, I don't want to be like in floppies when all these things are going on, you know?
Oh yeah. I do think about that, about if I did have to get off the damn plane, I don't want to be in fucking flip flops. I want to be in shoes.
And then I kind of have like an OCD thing too, where like I wouldn't wear stuff like that because I don't want any part of my skin to touch the airplane. So I want shoes, socks, jeans. I want a hoodie with a hood up.
Yeah.
Where like the only entrance to my face is like a nose and mouth. Like,
yeah,
that's always how I feel comfortable on airplanes in my own like mini cocoon.
No, that's very, I agree. I back that.
I don't know if it's OCD a little. I do the same thing when I start bus touring. It's kind of a strange trickle down I do because, you know, I don't know who was fucking in there last. It could have been like, you know, the bunk literally could have been like the drum tech from Slayer like 2 days ago, who's just the fucking grossest dude. Like, I don't know. So it kind of takes me a while to get cozy. And like the first 2 or 3 days, I sleep in there fully clothed.
Right.
With like hood up, like nothing touching any of it. Like I'll even cover the pillow. And then usually I'll be like, I'll be like, I got to take off my socks tonight. Like I got to like just get. And then by the end of the tour, I'm in my underwear. I'm just flopped in there like it's my own.
You're the guy polluting the bunk for the next
guy. By the end. Yeah, maybe that's why I'm so self-conscious is because I'm the polluter on the other side. Yeah. But yeah, it's a strange like trickle down. I don't understand. So he just walks in like, let's go. I'm like, I stay up the first 2 nights listening to fucking Drivers Are Hitting Rumble Strips and shit, you know? Right. Like, I don't know this guy. He could be on crystal meth.
Oh, yeah. So
we're doing it a little unorthodox today. Intro first before we speak to our guests, which is fun. And I'm sure we're going to get a lot of stories about what I was just talking about, you know, old times in the van, the road, old bands. These guys were right in the thick of it, right in the heart of it. I mean, what's cool is, you know, I am a slight generation younger than Josh and Carl. So when I was getting into the hardcore scene, like them and their scene was already like mainstays, you know, like Trisco Records already existed. Josh was doing these like fairly legendary shows at his house. He had a zine that was pretty popular. And I met Josh because I was doing Elks Lodge shows. And I actually booked the first Trustkill package tour, which was Harvest, Brothers Keeper, and Despair, probably in like 1995. And that's how I met him. And then Carl was always with Endeavor, who was like a really awesome local band, and ended up putting their records out and touring with them. And that was like my connection to him was through Endeavor. So I was like a little kid and they were like dudes already. So if you notice a certain tenor in this interview, it's because both Josh and Carl still think I'm 15 and they treat me as such, which is fine by me. Like they both still see me as like little chubby hardcore kid just going, what's up guys? Like, can I get a couple CDs for my merch distro? Can I fuck one of your bands? Like, you know, I must've been such a pain in the ass. So I'll always give him a.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fast for that. I ended up having some great times with both of them. And Carl, you know, sang for the band Nora that I roadied with. And we spent an amazing amount of time over the years together. But I really wanted to have him on because the story is so unique in the idea that two kids who were really good friends coming up in the scene, coming from the same area, both like founded sort of seminal hardcore labels that broke some of the bigger and better bands that have come out of the scene in like that 20-year period.
Yeah, definitely.
And then both subsequently like got huge and signed these deals and it went a different way and they recreated what they do later in life. But they've always been friends the whole time. And it's kind of this bizarre, unique story. Like, I don't know. You just don't see it very much. Like usually only one person gets out alive, you know, and it's unique that, you know, two not only did it, but they did it successfully. And one of the reasons I wanted to have them on is because I'm like, they must have been competing with each other the whole time, trying to sign each other's bands while still being friends. And it's just it's such a unique circumstance. So let's get into talking with, Carl Severson and Josh Grabel.
Three, two, one.
Oh, we're just diving right in. All right.
Yeah. No, this is how we do it on the program, gentlemen.
Okay. Well, I like that Chrome says that everyone has had their health checks.
It does make me feel confident about getting in a virtual room with you two. You know, God knows about your health checks.
The new variant.
We don't want a virus.
Through Chrome.
Chrome.
Google. Then that's going to be the next variant is Google Chrome, of course. spread via via some overlord masters.
Yeah, see, I don't know if anybody else gets it, because when the last one came out, Omicron, like the fucking unpronounceable one that just came out.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as I saw that, the only thing I thought was Unicron from Transformers. And, I just don't know if everybody thought my joke was as good as I thought it was, but like, I kept calling it the Unicron variant. My wife was just like, that's not what it's called. And I was like, it's what it's called to me. Look at this guy.
I gotta be honest, if you said it without the Transformers reference, I would not have gotten it.
Yeah, see, I'm a loser, and it was the 30th anniversary of that movie recently, and I took my kid to see it. There was like four of us in a theater. It was, you know, mildly, it was awesome, but you know, I was like, oh, okay, cool. I thought it was going to be packed out. Nope.
Have they rebooted Transformers? Is there like a new one for the new kids?
Dude, are you serious?
Oh, the movies. I know they made the movies, but did they do like another show?
Yeah, there's been multiple shows. There's been three seasons on fucking Amazon. I mean, gotcha. Not Amazon. Gotcha. What's it called? Netflix, whatever.
Now, yeah. You would have known this without kids, wouldn't you?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm not proud, but yes.
He sure would have.
So I'm so glad to have you two in here. I feel like this is like a unique experience where it would be so much harder to get you two to hang out with me than to do this, like at That's the same true. Time, you know? That's true. Like, so this is our chance to just catch up, you know?
I know, it's good. I feel like we actually all live kind of near each other, but...
We do. I mean, we all went to fucking straight dad town, you know?
I mean, it's true. It's true.
The burbs.
You gotta do it. So I don't know. I mean, I wanted to, speaking of the burbs and all that, like, you know, I wanna dig back into the story, because I feel like, you know, there's been a lot, written about, you know, Ferret, Trustkill, both of you individually, but you know, one of the fascinating things is the fact that you guys have known each other for what, like 30 plus years at this point, right?
It is so, 30 plus. Actually, that's terrifying.
So
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, wait, I was like, is it really 30 plus? Oh shit, it is.
Yeah, it is. Right? You're like, no, it's not. That's ridiculous. Yeah, you're like, oh wait, but yeah, right. It was.
Yeah. Yes.
So do you, like, when did you meet?
We met in 1990, probably.
Uh-huh.
So 32 years ago in a math class, I want to say.
Yes.
Okay.
Math like class. Like trig? Was it trig?
It was trig. And it was funny because I didn't stay in the class. We met, but this was my move in high school. I would sign up for all the harder classes.
Right.
And I would sign up for the harder classes, and then I would feel them out for like the first week. And I'd be like, oh shit, I'm going to actually have to work in this one.
Too much.
And then I would drop out and go to the lower, because I figured out early on that like an A in an easy class was worth as much as like a B or C in a hard class. So sure. I was like, well, fuck trying.
Easy. Yeah.
So
stay in the aggregate there.
And yeah. So yeah, cause Josh was a year ahead of me, but I was in that class and we met, and then, but yeah, I didn't stick it out because I was like, oh, they're gonna make me try.
Okay, and, so since it's trig, I guess this is by high school already.
Yeah, we met in high school.
I think I was a junior, you were a sophomore, right?
Yeah, I moved. My dad was military, so I kind of lived all over, and then he got stationed in Jersey in the 90s, and that's when I moved up here,
First day of trig, I'm sitting there and I look over and I see this kid with a, I think, did you have a shaved head at the time? I think you may have.
No, I still had
it. You still had hair?
Yeah, still hair. And, I haven't lost it yet.
But you were wearing some hardcore shirt, like Chain of Strength, or I don't know what
it
was.
Yeah, I had a Chain of Strength or a Gorilla Biscuit shirt on. I know when I met Kyle, I was wearing a Gorilla Biscuit shirt because that's why he talked to me. So then, like, oh, you like them, bro?
And I was like, oh, cool. So like back then, of course, hardcore kids were, you know, few and far between.
Sure.
And there was maybe two or three in our whole school. So to see Carl across the room, I was like, oh shit, I got to talk to this kid.
Yeah. Especially like a new kid in school with a hardcore t-shirt. It's like, he's one of us. We got to put him into
exactly.
the fold. Right?
I mean, at
yeah.
that point it was me and Kyle White, Michael Wunder, and Aaron Evans. And that was
it. Oh yeah.
Aaron wasn't even there yet. Cause Aaron was,
okay, so it was me, Kyle, and Mike.
Yeah, Aaron was my brother's grade. So him and Eric, right. Eric were in like seventh or eighth grade by then. Yeah.
And what town was this?
This is Eaton Falls. Or Eatontown.
Yeah, Eatontown, same thing.
And Josh, you grew up there, right? You were there the whole time?
Yeah.
So
born and raised, still like, here.
Out of that crew, since I know all the names you just mentioned of Kyle White, Mike Olmstead, who was the first? Like who was like the one who opened it up all of you?
Me and Kyle, kind of our story starts at the same time because both our first hardcore show was Underdog in Belmar in 1987.
Whoa.
Because yeah. Kyle's older brother took us.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So we were like little fucking kids. I mean, I was, you know, 12 or 13, but I also looked like I was probably 8 at the time.
Right. Yeah. with facial hair.
Yeah. I was the smallest kid there, but it was, you know, on the shore in Belmar, summer 87.
What kind of venue? Like,
it was like a VFW hall.
Nice.
And we met up with like the Underdog dudes before the show, and Robbie like took us to some skate spot. And
nice.
So like all that shit was blowing my mind as like a 12 or 13 year old kid.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, that was our first show.
And what like, were you like a sports kid? What were you before that made you like find
Carl's
something
laughing.
Like that and be like, Carl's like, no, he was not a sports kid.
Dude, keep in mind, Josh weighed 85 pounds when he graduated high school.
Like,
that's not
wet.
An exaggeration. Yeah, right. That's actually true.
I was little. So
Where'd you get that mouth with that size? It's remarkable.
I played soccer and baseball and all that. And then I wanted to wrestle. And I went to wrestling camp at Brookdale, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
And then I got to high school and I was going to wrestle. And the coach was like, yeah, if you were like 20 pounds heavier, I could see, but you're going to die. So you can't wrestle.
Okay. He's like, there's not even a weight class for you.
Yeah, you're literally 20 pounds away from the smallest weight class.
From the smallest weight class.
And we're so old, they didn't let girls do shit yet. So
I didn't wrestle. And then, you know, I was a skateboarder and like a BMXer. Okay. And so that just kind of took over my life. And then hardcore came around and that was it.
Yeah. What about you, Carl? Like, what was the place you came from prior to going there?
So we bounced around a bunch. My dad was Air Force, so we were around a lot. I was in Virginia prior to moving up to Jersey. But before that, I had lived everywhere from Hawaii, which I don't remember. That would have been awesome. I remember living in Alabama.
Wow.
Not as exciting.
Not as cool.
You were in the Philippines?
I lived in the Philippines for 2 years, and that was cool because I was like fifth and sixth grade, so I was old enough that like
that's interesting.
I could learn something, you know? So I lived there when Marcos was it fucking declared martial law and was a dictator. So
Whoa.
Like we're on an American base, but you still saw, you know, like my dad was military and, you know, Marcos was like, oh, I'm going to pop some shit off. And my dad wouldn't come home for like 3 days.
Whoa.
And,
wow. You know, do you remember what was going on? That's pretty, I never knew about that. That's crazy. What, like, did the family like actually know? Were you like kind of worried?
I mean,
something
we knew
crazy
because,
was about to go on.
We knew to the extent, I mean, I guess I know more now in hindsight back, but yeah, I mean, we knew that, you know, like dad would like come in the house and like get a bag, even though he's going to literally be in an office that's like 3 miles from our house.
Right.
And he would get a bag of clothes because we knew he was just going to be working 24 hours a day and he wasn't coming back. And,
crazy.
But yeah, we were there. We moved there like right after Marcos declared martial law, which is becoming a dictator.
Right. Yeah.
That dude was a piece of shit. And, and we were there for just around 2 years. So we were there for when Aquino, when she kind of, there was the coup and then, which I forget the details. I don't know if it was her or her husband. I'm pretty sure her husband got killed over it. And then she became like the first actual elected official, elected president.
Crazy.
And that was crazier because more people died during that election than when Marcos became, you know, declared military law and all that sort of stuff. So that's like the worst. They're like, so it was cool to live there in that, you know, I saw something that would never had an opportunity to see in your average, little white kid from America wouldn't see to like see that sort of stuff firsthand.
Do you think in hindsight that like some of the, early like messaging and like punk and hardcore kind of like rung with you? You literally watched like the fall of a government, reforming of a government like that.
Yeah. And watching like a dictator get ousted and stuff. I remember because we would go like, you know, we lived on a base and the military base, which is gone now, but like the base literally had a concrete wall around it with like barbed wire and broken glass on top of it and stuff like that. Okay. And the first year we lived there, that was our backyard. Our backyard fence was that wall.
Whoa.
And, the wall, you know, in hindsight, if you're going to build a wall around something, like make it higher because dudes would just hop over that shit and steal our bikes all the time and stuff like that.
Wait, how high was it?
It was probably like 8 feet. Like,
yeah, easily.
It wasn't that tricky.
Sure, but, sure.
But yeah, you know, we watched a lot, but we would go off base. You know, we'd go into Manila and things like that because my parents were always like, oh, we'll go, you know, we want to go. We live here. We want to see sights and stuff like that. Yeah. So we would do that. Wow. But I remember one time he went and it was kind of during the whole start of Aquino coming into power. And we ended up in I actually have a vivid memory of this because we were in our parents. I think it was like a Datsun. Actually, I know for a fact it was a Datsun, 1981 Datsun station wagon because it ended up becoming my first car later on.
Nice.
But I remember like me and my brother were like in the back because it was station wagon. We were in the back because we wanted to look out and we like drove like by through / a protest. I still remember what the Aquino sign was that people were holding up with their fingers and all that sort of stuff. And it was, you know, that sort of thing was cool to see, you know, and like, and honestly, they ousted a dictator and, you know, like it was, you know, I was young, so I don't know all the details of it, but at the time it was, you know, I knew some days I was like, oh, I was never scared as I guess I could have been because, my mom was like, no, shit's cool.
And I was like, okay, right. They kind of they gave it like a soft blanket. What was actually happening?
Yeah,
that's wild.
But yeah, then I was in Virginia after that. And when I first found out about like, you know, like punk and hardcore when I was in Virginia, I actually, oddly enough, through sports, which is 7 seconds would be bummed on, but, I got into playing lacrosse and, my school back then didn't have like an actual lacrosse team. So I'd play in like, you know, like a pickup league and, randomly, and it was like all ages. Like I was in ninth grade and we were playing with like seniors. So like dudes were just murdering me. But there was a handful of these dudes that were like hardcore kids that would like from Virginia and they would like go into DC all the time. They go to the 930 club and stuff like that for shows. And but I thought it was cool and they gave me a couple tapes. That's like first time I heard like Minor Threat and, you know, some Agnostic Front and some older punk stuff.
Nice.
And I was kind of I was a little skater kid before that. So I had been hearing, you know, like Subhumans and Ill Repute and the more punk side of stuff leading into that. But then these guys were like Minor Threat and, you know, a Gorilla Biscuits tape. And at one point, you know, I snuck out for my parents and because a couple of the older guys, they were going into DC and they were going to go to, I forget the name of the store. There was some famous store in DC that had like, you know, you could actually go buy Revelation t-shirts and shit like that. Had vinyl and stuff like that. Right. And we went in there and, you know, like I brought like, that's the Gorilla Biscuit shirt that I was wearing when I met, you know,
it just
Josh
takes one
Kyle.
Shirt, right? Like just when it's like putting like, it's like raising a flag when you buy like your first hardcore punk shirt, you know that there's those other like skate punk kids around and you're like, all right, like.
That was the coolest thing about when Josh and I grew up. I mean, those guys I mean, first off, my life prior to moving to Jersey, like, you know, we moved all the time. I was pretty goofy looking, freckles, not the best hair, you know, like, and, I spent a lot of time getting, you know, picked on and, you know, like, you know, my life was like an after school special, you know, and,
kid in the South. I mean, I can't help, but because it's in the South, imagine like, the kids throwing rocks at Forrest Gump, you know? I just imagine kids throwing rocks at Forrest. You know, you're tall. Yeah, it seems.
It was rough. But in Jersey, it was such a weird thing because like that first day, I was like, wait, I just made friends. So I was like, I haven't had friends. Right. You know, I'm like, my brother is close to my age. So like I had a friend to the extent that he liked me, you know? And You've met him, so who knows if he likes me.
Yeah, that stopped a long time ago.
Yeah.
Oh, is Eric actually likes you or not?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure about myself either, kind of thing.
But yeah, no, when we, you know, when I got in Jersey and I met Josh and Kyle and Mike Olander, and we kind of like, you know, like they, you know, I kind of rolled into that crew, and it was, it was funny because it was like we, you know, it was like a handful of hardcore kids. Our friend Lou was there. But it was also like there was a couple hippies at the school, and, you know, so it was basically everybody that was like slightly weird or like, you know, didn't play sports or that sort of thing. Like it was our little group. So it wasn't like just a bunch of hardcore kids now or something like that. It was like our whole, it was like a whole mix of a bunch of like different people, but we all, you know, we had, you know, a friend that was like way, way into Nine Inch Nails, and we're like, yeah, shit's lame. But, I mean, who knew? They were awesome. But we were all friends. You know, so, but it was cool because that was a huge step for me. It was pretty significant in my life because
things you found the crew.
Changed a lot. Yeah.
And I mean, and it's sort of what's cool about it, you know, in hindsight is like, if you told someone from the outside who's just a huge hardcore fan that like you two and Mike, you know, like went to high school together and were part of the same crew, they'd be like, what? Same school? That's like, it's like one of those weird clusters of, you know, people who went and did like, you know, kind of crazy things in this scene, like being together.
No, it's true. It's kind of like it was our version of like all those dudes out in Orange County that grew up together.
Kind
of.
Like, yeah.
You know, I mean, they're all a little younger than us, like not that much, but a little. But it's like, you know, there was that whole group of people out in Orange County that all grew up together and ended up doing, you know, seminal bands and you know, all that sort of shit. Like we had our group and it was considerably smaller. But
I mean, in hindsight, you know, very influential.
Yeah.
It was John Hiltz, what did he call us? The Baggy Pants Crew?
No, it was the Eatontown Silly Pants Crew. Oh, yeah. That's what he called us.
Silly Pants Crew, yeah. That was because that was derogatory too, by
it's
the way.
Nice to hear John Hiltz was John Hiltz back in the early.
Oh, yeah. He was because we were like the only, like, I mean, we would show up with our, like, you know, our straight edge beaded necklaces.
And, yeah, right.
You know, big baggy, you know, because we were this weird mix of like skaters and straight edge kids and that sort of stuff and like, you know, sweater pants. Our sweater vests and baggy pants and stuff like that. And
we would always go to the punk shows. Sweater vests when I met you. I even found it suspect at my age.
Well, I mean, but we all have our issues. Dude, it looked good, man. I'm just saying it worked at the time.
Trust me. I mean, you saw me in those days. I was the worst. So who was the first to like be proactive, like getting into the shows? Like, Josh, when did you start doing shows in the basement or doing the zine? Was that all still in high school?
I feel like when Josh went to college is when everybody was like, whoa.
That's kind of when it started. Yeah, I mean, I didn't do anything in high school.
Okay.
I mean, I did. I went to shows and that was it.
Right.
But I think maybe I started taking photos of bands. That could be. I don't know. But that probably didn't start until college either. But yeah, I mean, I went to Syracuse and in 1992... And I started a zine with some friends shortly thereafter that I met up there. And then a year later, I started a fanzine called Trust Kill. And I believe that's right around the time that, Carl, you started a fanzine called Ferret.
Yeah, well, you started Peel Me a Grape.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the one beforehand.
That was the one. And then you started Trust Kill. And I still remember, like, you came home from college. And we were like chilling in your room. And I remember I thought this was the coolest thing. I fully remember this. Like we were coming
like,
over to...
Whoa, you did a zine.
Yeah. Like, well, it wasn't even that. Like, but you were already doing the zine. And, you know, by then we were all... I was a senior in high school. You were home from college. And we were like, you know, it's the summer. So we're just going to go to shows. And that's when we were going to Kyle's stepdad's
beach house.
Point Pleasant, which was amazing.
Yeah.
But I remember we walked into your room and you had like 22 voicemails on your answering machine in your room. And I was like, holy shit, that is so cool. He's got 22 voicemails. Now, if I get 22 voicemails, I'm throwing my phone in the trash and killing myself.
Wait, who were they from?
That was back when you did the zine. And it was people like, yo, review this record. Yeah, but like I sent you a demo and I was like, wait, he gets mail and voicemails? Like, this dude's so important. And I just remember thinking like, that's so crazy.
That's funny.
Later on in my life, I hated all those things.
Actually, so it was that summer that I came back after my freshman year of college that I did the first shows in the basement of my parents' house.
Okay, yeah.
And that was actually only because John Hiltz called me and was like, hey, there's these bands on tour from California and they need a show and I can't do it. Can you?
Wow.
He was probably like, there's these bands on tour from California and I hate them.
Well, that's actually, that could be true.
So what, because
it was Mean Season and Unbroken. And I don't think he really like knew either band, which is fine.
Yeah.
But he was like, dude, I can't do the show. Can you? And I'm like, all right. So like, I just asked my parents and they were like, yeah, sure. The basement is a piece of shit anyway. Who cares?
Wow. And you hadn't done shows at all. Like it was just random that John hit you up about that.
I hadn't done anything. I think maybe we had talked about at his house, like I would like to do a show that could be.
Sure.
But yeah, he called me and I was like, well, how do I do a show? And he's like, well, I'll just come down and I'll bring a PA and you'll give me $50 and that'll be the show. And I'm like,
all right. And Josh's like, what's a PA?
Yeah. That's crazy.
So it was Unbroken and Mean Season.
And I imagine like probably some fucking people showed up at your house for that show.
I added Still Life. I don't remember how I knew about Still Life, but they were on tour and needed a show.
They were so good.
They were so good. Dude, seriously,
how would they find you? Like, think about back then, because kids won't get this now. Like,
oh, dude, we barely
had computers.
I got stories about that. Oh, wait, so I added Iconoclast too.
Nice.
We hung out with those dudes all the time. Those guys were great.
So it was Iconoclast, Still Life, Unbroken, Mean Season. That was the first show.
Crazy.
But yeah, Carl, it's funny you mentioned that because there was one show I had where Snapcase, I don't know if I knew them by this point, but they were like, oh, there's a show at Josh Grabel's house, but we don't know how to get a hold of him or where he lives. So they were on tour
and I just drive around.
Yeah.
The story goes that I was literally like having a show that night and they stopped at some gas station in the area and asked if they knew Josh Grabel and someone did.
Whoa.
At the gas station and they told him how to get to my house and Snapcase just fucking showed up.
No way. Oh, I love that. Yeah, it's true, though. But back in those days, you just had to get to the town.
I don't know how we did anything in the 90s.
Yeah.
Do you remember there was like, because we were like all like vegan and stuff, and we'd go to Taco Bell, and there was the one little like younger
vegan kid. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was like, y'all vegan? Look it up.
And I remember, Josh, didn't your flyers have directions to Taco Bell on them, if I recall?
Of course, because I got sick of answering everybody, because everyone would be like, yo, where can we get food? Where's Taco Bell?
And there was only Taco Bells in New Jersey.
I'm going to put it on the flyer. Yeah, back then there really wasn't many.
Oh, back then we would literally like, what do you guys want to do today? It's like, we'll skate, but let's drive a half hour to Taco Bell first.
Yeah. It was like a thing. So it went off from there. And so at what point, I feel like the first time I heard of you, Josh, was when you did the fake interview with Hare Krishna.
Yeah, that got around.
Is that like how
I mean, for what it's worth, just for what it's worth, the show that we were at.
Yeah.
Was that in Princeton, Josh?
Are you talking about the 108 show?
Yeah, the 108 show that you ended up, you did the interview afterwards. Oh, no. I guess you did the interview beforehand, but we were at the show watching them and you and I were both I mean, for whatever, it didn't matter for me, but for Josh, it was funny because we were literally like crawling on people's heads singing along. But Josh was.
Dude, I was like, that's a fucking great song that he wrote about wanting to kill me. I'm going to sing along to it.
Yes, that's right. That's what it was. Yeah, we were both like crawling up, singing along to the song about how much he hates you.
Awesome. I'm like, you fucking hate me. It's cool. I'm going to sing along to it.
Was Deathbed about you or something?
That song, Scandal.
Wow, that's about
the song where he goes, and I want to tear you to fucking pieces.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah.
Rob Fish wrote that for you.
Yeah.
So wait, give me the background on that, because here's the funny thing about you, Josh, is you've always been a rabble rouser.
Yeah.
You know, you like stirred up shit. Like,
yeah.
Which is, you know, funny.
I stir up shit.
you know, yeah. I'm friends with you guys. I always liked it, but like,
you just didn't want to be on the other side.
Right. So why at the time did you like pick like the Krishna scene to go after? Like, what about it was like bumming you out?
I mean, you gotta think about the Krishna scene at that point. I mean, Josh, I don't want to speak for you, but I know it. like Shelter was one of our favorite. Shelter was one of our favorite bands. I mean, we would just like sit in our rooms and we knew every word, you know, every song and all that sort of stuff. But like at the same time, you know, and Josh even more so than me, you know, like none of us were huge fans of religion. But if you look at, especially back that era of hardcore, like, you know, Krishna was like, you know, we would go to shows and there was always Krishna dudes there and they were always handing stuff out and talking to people and things like that. So it was kind of always that one, you know, in particular was a little more in your face.
Yeah. So I did that interview. I remember doing that. And just thinking it was funny. But it was, you know, looking back on it, it was pretty offensive if you were a Hare Krishna. And so the zine came out, you know, a lot of people thought it was hilarious. A lot of people were offended, whatever. And then like that summer where I'm having shows at the house and there was, it was Shift and Endpoint and Falling Forward.
God, that, yeah, I remember.
And maybe like
all your shows were good.
Yeah, they were all epic. Yeah. There was like one or two other bands. So, and everyone from Equal Vision drove down from Albany to come to my house to see this show. But also apparently Steve Reddy was like real pissed at me.
Yeah.
So Carl, you remember this shit. So like in the middle of the show, I don't know when it was, Steve comes over and he's like, he's real irate and like red and fuming. And he's like, why the fuck would you do that? And I was like, dude, I just thought it was funny. I'm sorry, you know. And like, he like jacked me up against the wall and was like, if you ever do that shit ever again, I'm going to fucking kill you. And I was like,
whoa. Oh, dude. Really? He got like physical with you?
Oh, yeah. But I was like, dude, this is, I'm in my house surrounded by all my friends. Like, what are you going to do? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, immediately he would have kicked my ass for stepping up and helping you.
And I mean, you know, back then I was this little skinny vegan straight edge kid, weighed 90 pounds. And Steve was like kind of big and scary and like 10 years older than me. So that was crazy. But, you know, years later we squashed the beef and became friends and, you know, been in business ever since.
Did you have to like be like, yo, my fault. I shouldn't have interviewed Krishna. Did you ever eat crow about it?
That was never my style. Yeah. I don't remember exactly what I said to him at the time, but I'm sure it was just like, dude, I just thought it was funny. Sorry. Like, I didn't mean to like crush your whole life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but it was a sensitive thing. It is when I think about it in hindsight, like all of us like being in pylons and singing Hare Krishna lyrics that we had no idea what the fuck they were saying.
Yeah.
It's pretty ridiculous.
It was a little, I mean, you know, at that time, it's like, everyone had a Shelter t-shirt. The band was huge.
They were huge.
We were still sad that Youth of Today broke up. You know, it was just all that stuff.
And it's also, it's like, it's not like every single song, you know, was about Krishna. I mean, if you go through and listen to like the Shelter stuff, there's a lot of like really cool, like, you know, socio-political sort of stuff in there. Mm-hmm. They wrote literally one of the best pro-vegetarian songs you'll ever listen to. I mean, well, actually, that was 108, not Shelter. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, and we were always amazing stuff there.
We were always like first in line to get the free Hare Krishna food at all the hardcore shows.
Yes,
oh yeah, good soup. Great soup.
I was like, I will make a fake interview about your God, but I want some fucking free food.
But keep in mind, all this was happening when we were between the ages of 15 and 18.
Right.
Like, like barely smart. Like the fact that we were even allowed to like drive cars and interact with people, like in hindsight, you look back on it and you're like, Jesus Christ, not only we shouldn't have been doing that, but like, you know, Josh was doing shows and we were both like, you know, like making quote unquote, you know, like fanzines that like putting, you know, words out there to people and like,
yeah,
like we didn't know shit.
Yeah, I mean, dude, you put a photo of my balls in your zine.
I did.
What was the deal with that? But I was just telling my wife about that, how I used to grab people's cameras at parties and take a picture of my balls.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So they would Do you remember that time Nate Gluck came home from an Ensign tour?
Oh, it's the best photos ever. They're so horrible. Oh, my God. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I mean,
we're
talking open buttholes, like a lot of wires.
That was an Ensign tour.
Yeah.
It was an Ensign tour, and it was Chris Worrell's camera. And whenever he wasn't looking, they took his camera and would take photos. And then it was the kind of that you also like, you know, imagine this, you get home from Europe. It's like your first tour of Europe, you know,
you're just like, wait to see my pictures.
Yeah. I'm going to get all my pictures taken of sightseeing and hardcore. And, you know, back then when you get photos developed, there's like some high school girl that's just like developing them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he had like six stacks of, you know, photos. And like every other one was somebody just like staring directly into the camera, but holding their balls or like, yeah, I mean, dude, it was, I actually remember sitting in his room looking through those being like, holy shit, this is next level.
Did they even deny printing them at first or like giving them to him?
I don't remember that, but I know it was
something. Yeah.
I know I haven't thought of that in probably 20 years, but I fully, cause that's when he lived with Chris Ross.
Yeah. Yeah, and it certainly was.
Yeah, because Ross was on that tour as well, and he, you know, Ross was always the adult, so he never
did it. But you know, he was just chuckling, smoking cigarettes while it was happening,
right?
You know, it wasn't like his balls, but it wasn't. He wasn't stopping them. You know, yeah, that's fucking awesome. So all right, I didn't even know Ferret started from the zine. So it's hilarious. Like, so even back then, you guys were like semi competing with each other.
Never competing. Like, I was always like, it had kind of gone like this. Josh got up there to school, and Josh, if I'm correct, Jason Jordan was our first friend to have like a real job in music. Like you were doing your zine, and then Jason got a job at Sony or some shit.
That was a couple of years later, but
that was still the time when I was starting doing something and I was just like, Josh is doing something and now we got this other dude like, you know, like he's not even doing hardcore shit. Like he's a hardcore kid. He was an Encounter and our friend and stuff. And now he's like, you know, actually getting paid and has like a life. And Josh, I think at the time had, cause I didn't do anything until after Land of Greed came out, which was the first record, you know, Josh did.
Sure.
And,
with Jason,
you know, yeah, with Jason. And I was just always like, you know, and it was never competition. I mean, honestly, nobody helped me get started more than Josh did.
I mean, I designed like your first 10 records.
I think something like that. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know you were Ferret's early graphic designer.
I was.
He was.
Yeah,
he was.
Yeah. I did almost every record. And I designed your logo what did I do with your logo? The first logo or the second logo I made? I don't know.
No, because like, the second logo was the girl that Mike from, at the time, Overcast, later Killswitch, he did that.
Right.
Oh, no, the one before that. Yes, that was you and...
Yeah, me and Joel.
No, it was a Varga girl. Massive copyright infringement.
Me and Joel did...
Scan that shit in and put Ferret on it.
Yeah, well, we put a dead chick on the cover of that Disembodied record, too, so, you know.
Yes, that's true. Tara... Yeah, that to this day, Tara's like, I hate that cover.
It's like, oops.
And that was back when you could like, hey, I'm designing your record and you're not going to approve it. But like, it's done and I'm going to print it. And that shit doesn't fly.
Yeah, anymore. Yeah. Pre-email, yeah. I mean, what, are you going to send proofs? Like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. What are you going to do?
Yeah. You know? Just got to describe it.
Our friend Spleet, he worked in an archives management place. It's just like a warehouse full of old shit that businesses don't know what to do anymore.
Oh.
And he worked there with like some of the dudes from Lifetime and stuff like that. And obviously they weren't good employees.
No. And then, so they would and like, then Spleet got in trouble for that years later. Remember when he was working?
He was stealing some shit, right?
No. He pulled a random photo of a woman to make a fake advertisement for Coney Island Whitefish.
That's right.
And randomly, like, this woman's, like, best friend went to Rutgers and opened up the newspaper the next day and was like, why is my friend in a, like, you know, used condom Coney Island Whitefish ad? you know, and got to the paper. I think that was Spleet's big controversy over there.
That's true. No, you're right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, because he was the one, he pulled a slide and it was like something from an autopsy. And it's actually horrible in hindsight if you look at it. It's just this woman's head and torso.
Yikes.
I don't think she's got fucking arms.
Jeez.
And she had like a name tag stuck on her chest. And I remember me and Josh sitting in his room. It was so fucking terrible.
I was like, dude, zoom
in. You got to take her name off.
Yeah, that's why if you look at the original album cover, there's like, I put like fake numbers over it or something.
Yeah,
right.
Because her name was on it. I was like, that's like someone's mom or some shit.
Now, like the early bands, like, you know, Carl, was Endeavor your first release?
Yeah, Endeavor is the first thing I did. That was, so, you know, obviously me and Mike went to school together. He started Endeavor while we were in high school.
Right.
I think me and Josh and Mike were actually in a graphic design class when they had graphic design classes without computers. and I remember making like the demo cover for the first Endeavor demo.
The yellow one?
Yeah, the yellow one. Yeah.
Honestly, it's so funny you say that because like the concept of graphic design pre-computer doesn't even like occur to me. Like I thought it was called something else. Actually.
Oh, dude, I was making like bootleg 7 Second shirts and like all kinds of stickers, and it was so fun.
Yeah,
we had a lot of stuff,
right? Letraset.
Yeah,
wasn't that the shit?
Yeah,
it was cost a fortune too.
Yeah, I remember my junior year, because nobody does anything their senior year. But I remember, you know, I was like, I got to get into college. And my parents like made me try. And so I ran for student office. I ran for vice president of the school. And, you know, Josh and Kyle, being the good friends they were, decided to help out unbeknownst to me. And Josh literally stole a photo of me, my third grade class photo. He stole it off
You were all fat and freckly.
Yeah, he stole it. No, but remember I had my sweet denim jacket on? Yeah, but he stole it off my fridge from my mom. And I walk out in the hallway and he had made flyers with it
all over the school.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and he was like, vote for, I forget even, I wish I had one because it was like a big picture of me from like first or second grade kid photo. And it was like, vote for Carl Severson and something obnoxious. And he literally had hundreds of them just stuck around the school.
And that's amazing. Like,
awesome.
It's a pretty good burn.
Did you win?
This is a good burn.
I did win. I did win.
Well, you're welcome.
Put that shit on my college transcript.
you are welcome.
Josh, you knew about shock ad campaigns.
Yeah.
Way back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's jump ahead a little bit just so we have enough time to really get into everything. So like, say we're in like the, you know, late 90s now, or like 97, 98, when both labels are kind of starting to really move. Like, what were you guys at the time? What was the intention with it? Because it's not as if like running a hardcore label was often like an enterprise that brought a lot of money in those days, or like something that would necessarily like be your life. You know, a lot of people did it on the side, and I know, you know, you guys actually went to school and were doing stuff like that. So what, by that time, like, what were you imagining? You were going to be the label owners forever, or were you still like having other ideas?
No, I think we were just like just trying to keep our head above water, and just like,
right,
we were just going to shows and just having fun and putting records out, and we didn't really think of the future.
I think we both had the same sort of thought where we just like wanted to be a part of it, you know, back then, like that. It's all we'd ever done. Like we grew up skateboarding, and then that was the music we got into. And then we started going to shows and, you know, and you watch all these other people in bands, and then the older dudes, you know, had labels and stuff. And like, you know, like I know for me, it was like, I just wanted to be a part of it. And
yeah.
I mean, that's why I, you know, with the Endeavor record, I was like, I mean, those guys were some of my closest friends. Whenever they went on tour, I was always with them. I always was carrying shit and stuff like that. And like, you know, when they were like, maybe we should put a record out, and I was like, oh, maybe I can do that. That's the way I could get involved and be part of it, you know?
Sure.
And it just kind of, you know, I don't even remember when I decided, where I was like, all right, I just want to keep going with this. I mean, you know, but it was one of those things where I was like, shit, I remember, I mean, by then I had graduated college and I was working at Roadrunner at the time.
Right.
Still doing my label full on. And, you know, but I remember I was just about $60,000 in credit card debt, running a label. But that was back when like you just check your mail every day and they'd be like, oh, here's a new credit card, 0% interest. You're like, sweet. I'll put out another record. And, you know, like, but yeah, I mean, I carried that for, you know, like years and, you know, it was just like, all right, no, I'll get over it. I'll get over that hump and stuff like that. And obviously, you know, eventually I did, but like that was the thing. I was just like, I don't know when it was. I was like, all right, I'm going to try and do this for real. And it was just always like, I really just want to be a part of it and just keep doing it.
Right. How about you, Josh? Did you have that moment?
I mean, I did. I think it was maybe a little bit later because I went to law school.
Right.
And fully intended on being a lawyer and practicing law.
Right.
But I, you know, I took 2 years off after college, went on tour with Carl and Endeavor and Harvest and Despair and all these bands. Went back to law school, and then 3 years later, the label was in a different spot, and I was like, shit.
Right. You had the option of
trying. I could probably like do this for real, but I can't do this and, you know, clerk for a judge in Freehold.
Right.
So I bailed on that clerkship, and then...
You had a clerkship, like worked out and everything.
Oh, I had a clerkship. Yeah.
Wow.
It was actually the year that my mom was president of the Bar Association.
Crazy.
So that looked really suspect.
You blew your Jewish nepotism so bad.
I did.
You blew it, Josh.
I did.
Yeah, so I remember
you could
Josh
have been country club living by now, you know?
I remember Josh telling me, he was like, ah, fuck, I got to tell my parents that I'm not going to do this whole lawyer thing.
Yeah, how did that go?
And I was like, yeah, I don't know how that conversation is going to go. But.
That was tough. My dad was not psyched. Okay. My mom was like, you know, I trust you and maybe you can come back in a year or two. And I was like, I don't know. We'll see.
That's wild. I mean, I can imagine as a parent too, be like, wait. What did I just put into Syracuse? Yeah.
I mean, my parents helped me out with college and that was awesome. And I love them for that. But law school, you know, I paid for it. So I knew that if I didn't practice law, like I'm going to have to pay off these loans somehow.
Right.
And that was pretty fucking scary to think about.
Sure. Yeah. That's terrifying. Carl, when you were at Roadrunner at the time, I just got to ask you that. Was that when you, you broke Nickelback, right?
I mean, not personally. I mean,
but you were
part of the team that worked.
Yeah, on it,
right? I was at Roadrunner for like a super interesting time.
Yeah,
like I was there for the first two Slipknot records and the first two Nickelback records, and you know, I got to work with Soulfly and Sepultura and you know some other stuff. And you know, I was only there 4 years. It's funny. I was talking with Monty the other day, and he was like, "Dude, I got interviewed for this History of Roadrunner thing. And he was like, I listened to that. He's like, you were only there 4 years. And I was like, yeah, it was only 4 years. He's like, I really feel like it was longer than that. And I was like, it was like a very cool, like formative years for Roadrunner. They had already gotten like, you know, like the growing out of it, I guess. And, so they were just starting to get big. And so I was there for the 4 years where they just kind of skyrocketed.
Sure.
You know, Island Def Jam bought them. And owned them for like, or owned a portion of it for 2 years or so. And then I don't forget the ins and outs of it, but eventually Warner bought Island out and then bought the whole thing. You know, we were there for all that. And I don't know, I got to hang out with a bunch of people that, you know, I probably shouldn't have, you know,
like Chad
definitely didn't want to hang out with me. And
did you spend any one on one with like Chad Kroeger?
I had some dude, you know, I'll tell anybody that'll listen this, the guys in Nickelback. Pretty fucking cool.
Pretty okay.
Like, everybody's gonna be like, "Oh, it's Nickelback. They suck." And I was like, "Dude, you know what?
Yeah, like, cause they become poster boys for like." So I even though I, you know, I don't particularly like the music, but I have been curious, like, why Nickelback? You know, like, why did they get it the worst like that?
Yeah. Why does everybody hate? You know, I mean, how many bands are massive that have songs that are just like, "This is fucking. Yeah. Is it good?" Or is it just like vanilla cupcake shit? Who knows? Like, I don't know, but yeah, like watching, you know, the stuff that the work wise with Nickelback was cool. I mean, at one point when I was there, they had done that song for the Spider-Man soundtrack with, it was like Chad and then the dude from Saliva.
Okay.
The click, click, boom song.
Right.
And so they did that. And then at the same time, How You Remind Me was on the radio. And they were, those songs were number one and two.
Wow.
And at the time, no one had done that shit since Michael Jackson.
No way.
Period. So that was kind of cool to get to like work through and all that.
Yeah.
And, but no, I mean, I spent, you know, like a handful of days where, I, you know, would spend all day with those guys or like, you know, end up, you know, at shows and then, you know, out with them afterwards at night. I mean, shit, I remember being at a diner in Manhattan with like Chad and one of the other dudes at like fucking 3 a.m. after a show. And they were honestly, we had a blast. They were a lot of fun.
That's nice to hear.
And it wasn't that- and the bass player, whose name I don't remember, which is, you know, is what it is, my bad. But that dude had a pretty substantial knowledge of like metal and some hardcore. Like,
okay,
you know, like that was pretty cool. Like he knew who Disembodied was. True
really?
Story. Yeah.
And did he think you were the guy from Puddle of Mud?
Oh, we're going to do that.
We weren't there yet. We weren't there yet. But okay. I was thinking about hitting it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This is actually for both of you because, you know, at that time, what you were talking about, Carl, like seemed like the time when like something broke differently for heavy music, where like you could actually have Slipknot like on semi mainstream radio. And like it seemed like
that was the crazy thing. There were two things right at that time frame, which was probably like 2000, 2001 around there. You had System of a Down and you had Slipknot, and they were two bands that ended up with gold records, but not because of radio. They had gold records that ended up with songs on the radio. Cause I used to, you know, like this is what I was taught by, you know, dudes at Roadrunner that were, you know, had been at this way longer than me. And then some of this is just what I watched from being there and learning, like for years, like you would look at it and be like, oh, if this band has a gold record, that means, you know, their labels at best got a tax write-off because you got to spend so much money
to market
fucking
it.
Payola and all the bullshit that goes with radio and all that. Right. Like, you know, I mean, I saw like the amount of money you spend was insane. And to go gold back then, you know, which is funny because that wasn't that big a deal, but like, you know, it was a big deal, but you're like, you're probably not making money. Whereas these two bands come along. that are like aggressive and chaotic and not writing stuff that's like, you know, Nickelback or even stuff that's even more poppy,
right.
You know, like, and they end up with gold records based off of like their, you know, quote unquote street following and like the organic, you know, then they went to radio and then they had an actual organic, real like swell around them because, you know, these kids were actually calling on the phones, radio stations, like play more fucking Slipknot.
Right.
Yeah. I think it was Wait and Bleed was the first yep. Slipknot single. And yep. I forget the System of a Down one, but like, and that propelled both those records to like go even further, you know, as opposed to like radio driving, you know, like labels paying radio basically to drive sales. Mm. You actually had sales driving radio, which in turn right. drove sales, which is what most people probably think. Like that's how it really should work, right? And be like, yes, in an honest world, that's how it should work.
But it doesn't.
But it's
often.
Never worked. It yeah. doesn't. Yeah. But that was really when things kind of like, you know, turned a corner for metal. And like,
yeah.
I mean, I remember being at Roadrunner. I forget what tour it was. I think it was Tattoo the Earth, but like, you know, Slayer and Slipknot were going out together and dudes in Slipknot were like, they were like, we will not play over Slayer. And
right.
People were like, yeah, but you draw way more, you sell more records, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, nope.
Yeah.
Not playing not over Slayer.
Not going to be able to do it.
Absolutely not going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, you know, it was a really cool period to be a part of. I mean, and I learned a ton and I'll never give more credit to everybody at Roadrunner. Like, everybody was cool to me and like they knew I had my label thing going on. And I think they like thought it was fun and cute and were like, hey, you know,
right.
maybe you should try this. And I was like, okay, you know,
yeah,
like,
cause yeah.
I was like, what's SoundScan? And, you know, and, but like, yeah, there was a bunch of people there that were always like, oh, this is cool. Cause and nobody cared because I always got my, you know, like I was good at my job. I got my work done. So it wasn't like I was just like, you know, fucking around
yeah,
doing
just
ferret
like pushing
stuff
that
while
the
I was
whole
there.
Time.
So like, you know, like it was a really, really cool period. And I got to work with people that have gone on to be like, you know, fucking monsters in the industry.
Yes.
I mean, you know,
yeah,
the closest thing I had to a mentor in music was Corey Brennan. And look at that dude now.
Yeah.
You know,
crazy. Now, like for both of you guys, did that, you know, around that time, it seemed to kind of, to raise the tide for like all heavy music. And so were the trickle offs of that, like, did you feel it at Trustkill? Like, were, you know, heavier records just getting a bigger audience, like in general?
I mean, I can tell you when the tide rose because Josh and I had a conversation about it and he managed to spend even more money than I did. It was, and Josh, and I know you'll agree. It was the Ozfest. I forget what year it was.
2003.
Yeah, oh, no. The one.
Oh, four.
Yeah. It was the hardcore Ozfest. It was the one where the second stage was like,
yeah.
Every Time I Die and Throwdown. And right. Who else did you had on? You had Throwdown and who else?
Bleeding Through.
Was that, you had Bleeding Through on twice?
Well, yeah. They came back and headlined that second stage, but the first
that's
year.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. The first year was Throwdown, Bleeding Through.
Yeah.
Every Time I Die, God Forbid. But I just remember it was all like, cause yeah. I remember Every Time I Die were the last band to get confirmed for that stage. Because at the time it was like me and Portland and Rick working together in my apartment in Jersey City.
Right.
And to get on that tour, like just to say yes to the offer, you had to send them a $75,000 check.
What?
And then you also had to figure out, yeah, that was the deal. Jesus, that was the, Christ. That was the quote unquote marketing contribution.
That's so fucked up.
Yeah.
And,
then you throw up another $50,000 to $75,000 for the one band for their bus and crew
and all that. Yeah.
And all that shit.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And we were, but that was the time. That's when it rose because we were looking at all right, Victory's doing it. Century Media is doing it. Right. Metal Blade's doing it. Like, you know, all these labels that, you know, Josh and I consider ourselves and want to be peers with are all doing it. So
yeah, we got
it's the kind of thing. If the water rises and you don't, you sink. So, you know, I mean, that was our mentality. We were like, all right, we're going to write $100,000 check. Like,
but what was crazy about that time period, that like early to mid 2000s was like, I don't want to say putting a band in Ozfest was a guarantee of record sales, but it was pretty fucking close. Mm. I mean, it was such a massive thing to be a part of that like virtually guaranteed your band success. And I don't know if that exists anymore.
No, like, nothing like that. Like any, and you know what makes it better is if at the time Victory goes and buys the band that you spent $100,000 to put on Ozfest, they go and buy their first EP that nobody knew about.
That was fun.
That Victory buys it and then reissues it with unapproved artwork by the band, just puts it out, puts a packaging sticker on it to make it look like a new record. Uh-huh. And it's on the fucking Best Buy Powerwall for fucking $5 less than their actual new album, man. Running like it's a new record. And you're man. Like, oh,
that was cool.
This is probably going to not help me make my money back.
Wow. It's great. So many interviews. You can go back to how Tony Victory screwed someone.
Oh my God. Oh, I mean, we could have a whole podcast about that. Just with me and Carl.
Yeah. I don't want to get into that aggregate right now. That's wild though, that it changed almost like, was there any part of like your, you know, you guys came from the hardcore punk scenes. Like, did you have any scruples about like the kind of worlds you were getting into? And,
Of course.
How did you navigate that like ethical?
Well, every day you're like, well, is this goofy or is this cool? You know, like,
right.
Is this corny? Is this going to sell records, but in a bad way? Is this going to attract better bands? You know, it's like every decision you make is it's all that chess game.
Right. I mean, were you able to like carry the kind of the punk rock like ethic into this world somehow?
Yeah. I mean, you try, you know?
Yeah. I mean, dude, do you know how much time I scrutinized over like how much I was going to sell a CD for at Middlesex County College shows, where I'm like, I'm going to sell this. I still remember this. Like I would like straight up worry about this constantly. Like, oh, kids are going to think I'm a money grubbing asshole. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, me and Josh were set up, you know, at folding tables next to each other at some show.
At every show and fest.
Yeah, always, yeah. And so, like, and I, at the time, I had just gotten a Disembodied album, which was, like, I think at the time, maybe the first full album I did. And Josh had the Harvest record. And, you know.
We're like, God forbid you sell it for more than $8.
Yeah. So you had a Harvest, you know, you had the Harvest CD for $10. And a kid, the same kid, I watched him because we're at the same table, buys the Harvest record for $10 and is like, okay, cool. And then literally leans over, looks at the Disembodied record and was like, oh, cool, man, how much? And I was like, $8. And he was like, dude, really? $8? I was like, the fuck? And that's when I realized, I was like, you know what? I don't care anymore. Fuck you guys. There's I'm killing myself.
Yeah.
You know, trying to make sure that I don't look like the money grubbing asshole. Yeah. And, you know, that sort of thing. And you know what? At a certain point, you just ease off.
Now vinyl costs $25 and a fest costs $250.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You want to buy
What the fuck happened?
we totally let it go. I mean,
you and I started wanting to get paid. That's what happened.
That's what it is.
We got mortgages.
Got to pay off that fucking school loan.
Yeah, exactly. All of a sudden your kids are hungry. But it is true. Like, we look back. I mean, we were like those kids in high school. We were like, oh my God, this band sold out. Whether it was like Quicksand or Sam I Am or, you know, Bad Religion, these bands that signed to majors and were in high school and be like, dude, it's fucked up. They sold out. And then like, you know, cut to 10 years later and be like, we were fucking wrong.
Yeah. So, dude, I remember when I finally made the decision to go from $5 four with a can of food to $6 five with a can of food. I was terrified. As I thought I was going to be castrated for that extra buck.
People are going to fucking hate you.
Yeah. Carl, I had a funny thing with you, and I don't even know if you remember this, but one of the first tours I went on, I asked you to give me a bunch of CDs to sell at as a distro. I think I took your stuff and I don't fucking, maybe Spirit Fall. Like, I don't even know who I took at the time. And, you know, of course, like every band who brought a distro with them, I sold like three CDs and ended up like ruining the box and half of them just fucking taking them around the country, which is what happened to everyone who took a distro. And, you know, I had no money for you.
Yeah, you were also like 15.
Yeah, about that. And But I remember, like, you gave me the Sonny from Bronx Tale thing, which I always remember, which was like, I was like, dude, why did you let me go? You never asked me for the money. Like, it was like, I mean, fuck, it was like $75, but it was like,
yeah.
And you told me, you're like, you know what? As I've gotten through the industry, like, I learned that sometimes you got to pay $75 to know you shouldn't work with someone again. They're like, I was like, oh, that is some fucking wisdom right there. Like,
yeah, I don't even want to think about going back and, you know, the various things that, like, I lost on. But I did always try and keep context. I mean, you know, like, I mean, you know, I've known you since, I literally think I met you when you were 15. And yeah. It's funny because back then I was like, oh my God, I'm so much older than this kid.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, give it a minute.
I was saying that in the intro coming into this. I'm like, listen, Josh and Carl aren't that much older than me, but they both still think I'm 15. Like, yeah.
But I still remember the first show I went to. Well, I don't know if it was the first show I went to that you did, but one of the Mansville Elks Lodge festivals, which is funny because that place is probably tiny. But in my head right now, I remember back
massive.
Like,
yeah,
it was just heads. Like Furnace Fest, you know, like, you know, like, and the people losing their shit and, you know, all that. And, you know, and I remember I was like, I can't believe you're doing this. This is crazy. You're a fucking child. And, you know, like, there's like, I mean, I don't know how many people were there. In my mind, it was like at least 1,000.
It was, you know? I mean, yeah, like for Matt shows when we were doing the fest, like, yeah, we weren't proper counting, but there was definitely like 800, 900 plus people squeezed into that Elks Lodge for those ones. That was pretty nuts. So was there ever a band like through these years that both of you were really, really trying to get? Like, were you like ever competing for the same bands, or did you have like kind of a behind the table conversation? Like, all right, you can go after that one.
I don't think it ever came up. Like, I think there were bands that we've both had that, like, one of us, like, for whatever reason didn't do and the other one did.
Oh, right.
You know, and in hindsight, like I know I remember talking to 18 Visions and not doing it because James consistently makes fun of me for it every time I see him. And obviously that worked out way better for them, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of bands that come around that we both look at and we talk to, whatever, but, you know, there's too many bands out there. Like, we're not going to hurt a 30-year friendship over a band, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that was one thing. And we tried to do that with other labels, you know, as well. Like, I remember, you know, whether it was like EJ
me and you were way too nice to all the other labels.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this is also true.
Because we always treated every other label like we treat each other.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden you're just like, oh, wait, you're signing one of my bands?
Cool. Yeah. Oh, now you're being a dick because I was being too fucking nice? Cool.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Carl, you know Static Lullaby still owes me like $60 for a bag, right?
See, that's a whole different podcast. You got to do a podcast with Rick and get him to talk about his year's tour manager.
Dude, I hit up Rick. It's pretty funny that
that's the band that broke him.
I hit up Rick to get like info about this. Of course, you know, Rick has, you know, nothing but great things to say about you guys and the labels. But most of the stuff he wanted to bring to me, I'm like, yeah, Carl's not going to talk about that. Like, I don't think he's going to talk about that one or that one or that one. Like, you know,
it's like, Rick, you know my wife, and you've met my kids call you uncle.
So yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. The one that he told me about. When did you break a mic somewhere and throw cash in someone's face?
Oh,
that sounds like a Carl move.
That was that was the one time Scott Lee did New Jersey Metal Fest instead of the New England Metal Fest.
Freezing cold.
Yeah, it was super cold.
No heat. No heat in Convention Hall.
Yeah, Convention Hall. Terrible sound. We played though; it was fun. Bunch of people there, and it was good. But yeah, at the end of the set, you know, your standard Sennheiser mic, you know, it's got the mic grill on it, and they're all smashed to shit, and worthless.
Yeah,
and it has no bearing on the sound of the microphone whatsoever at all.
No.
And we finished, and I was always nice. Like, I literally wrapped the cord up and everything. I didn't like drop the mic and walk away or anything stupid. I like wrapped the cord up and went over and handed it to. It wasn't even the sound guy; it was the monitor guy or whatever. The stage guy. And, And as I was walking away, I just hear him go like, what the fuck? And I turned around and I was like, what? And he was like, dude, you bent the grill on this. And I was like, yeah, dude, it was like that. Yeah. And I also know you can replace that for like pennies. Like, sure. It is what it is. And he just like, for, I don't know if he was just tired because he didn't realize he was going to, you know, have 50 bands, shitty bands in a row play all day long in the cold. Yeah. But he was just like super grumpy and wouldn't let it go. And whatever, he said something that poked my button as I was like walking away and he said something else and I kind of like snapped and turned around and I had like a $20 bill in my pocket and I went up to his face and just like put it in my hand and smashed it into his face and was like, here you go. Wow. Fuck you. Wow. And,
keep in mind, anyone that doesn't know who Scott Lee is, he's four times Carl Sass.
Well, that was the best part because the dude got all mad and wanted to fight me and I was like, all right. I was angry by then, so I was gonna, you know, I was like, all right, let's do it. And that's when it was Scott Lee and his stage manager who, God, I'm forgetting his name right now. He actually just passed away during COVID, which is horrible. But he was one of those dudes that was a fixture at New England Metal Fest. It was always awesome. But literally, I wish there was a photo of it because they were on each side of me. With one hand under each arm, just carrying me off the stage, my little legs kicking, and they're like,
"Let me get him! Let me at him! Let me at him!"
Yeah, yeah, it was, but yeah, that was. I was angry.
So I mean, I would like you guys have also had a unique path in the fact that, like, you know, both labels kind of wound up in situations where you ended up losing control and having to restart. Like, how much were you guys, supporting each other through that? Cause it kind of happened at a similar time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Carl was like a year before I did, but even when Carl was doing it, I was watching Carl do it going, I wonder if that's going to happen to me.
Yeah. So, I mean,
my whole scenario was, you know, I guess it was a little different and it was, you know, we had an opportunity, you know, at the time, some of the people that had been at our distributor for years had moved over to Warner.
Right.
Had come and was like, hey, you know, we'd buy you. And, at the time, I mean, in hindsight, yeah, not a good idea. But at the time, we're like, wow, this is more money than I possibly could imagine. Mm. So, you know, seemed like a good idea. But you know, it's a standard thing when you sell a company and, it's one thing you're like, well, I'm not selling all of it, but like, yeah, you are. I mean, that's the way the deal works.
Right.
And you sell it all. I mean, you sell a controlling share and then you have a term where it's a year, it's 2-3 years. And at the end of that, you know, they'll buy the rest at a multiple or you do what I did and, you know, you sell your company and 3 months later, Tower Record closes and the whole music industry completely and totally changes. The landscape is 100% different. Right. And every projection that we had done our deal predicated on became a fantasy.
Wow. Because
overnight when Tower closed, you know, all the rest of retail was like, well, shit, we could close. Well, we're going to spend way less money. And so we're going to stop, you know, buying as many CDs and all that sort of shit. And yeah, it fully changed overnight. So like in the end, you know, my deal was like, you know, it was good at the time. I mean, admittedly, I was super excited about it at the time.
Sure.
I mean, you know, like financially it was massive. If you put that deal in front of me again, I'd fucking laugh at you. I'd be like, what am I going to do with that kind of money? But at the time, it was more money than I could, you know, imagine. And it was amazing. And, you know, so it was what it was. I mean, I definitely, in hindsight, you know, I'd love it if I still had control of that catalog. I mean, shit, if I still had control of that catalog, I wouldn't have to do anything.
Right.
So, you know, it just kind of is what it is.
Yeah. So it was totally, it was totally tied into, when you say Tower, was that just the overall, like, you know, the end of digital, like, or the beginning?
No, it wasn't even that. Tower was the first huge retailer to close. And the way it used to work was store, like you put out a record and you would solicit retailers. Mm. And half the time that meant paying them and be like, all right. And they would take like, oh, I want you to take 20,000. I want Best Buy to take 20,000 of this Every Time I Die CD.
Right.
And I want Tower to take 20,000 and I want Circuit City to take 5,000, you know, all these various retailers. And they do it
And basically they would look at it and they'd figure out what, you know, they sell first week. And then they had an algorithm, you know, like a multiple. And they were like, all right, so we sold that. This is what we think we're going to sell in a year. And retail would literally keep that in their warehouses, what they thought they could sell over the course of the next year.
Wow.
So they would, you know, they would buy that from you and sit on it and then hope to sell it. Whereas, you know, Tower closed, they were like, you know, like, why the fuck would you sit on returnable stock for a year that you're not selling? You know, so everybody started thinking that. So they would take, you know, instead of taking a year's worth of stock, you know, it kind of trickled back. Well, trickle quickly. They'd be like, all right, well, we'll take 6 months until, you know, to the point like, and this was before digital even really kicked in.
Right.
You know, they were taking like, we'll take a month's worth. So all of a sudden right there, you know, labels that were like, all right, we're going to put out this record and you're, you know, selling hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of CDs for them to sit on. Now you're selling, you know, tens of thousands.
Right.
Even though you're going to sell the same amount, they're just not buying it, you know, all at once.
So this was like the pre-digital, but like the, when the music started going into the big box and stuff like that. Cause I remember when I worked at Curmudgeon, which I did, you know, the record store towards the end of it. And there was a couple of times we had to go to Best Buy to get something because it was cheaper at Best Buy than the distributor.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's like, because the label paid so much money to get it to be that cheap.
That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. If someone was on the power wall in Best Buy and in the Best Buy circular. So right there, you know, like
it's $5 a CD.
Yeah, yeah, it would be $5 a CD on the power wall.
Right.
But you paid them $20,000 for it to go in the power wall.
So crazy.
You know?
Yeah.
So, right, you know, like that's just how that was the cost of it.
Yeah.
And then if you wanted to be in the circular that went in the newspaper, you know, that was like another 10 or something like that. So you spend, you'd give Best Buy $30,000 to buy 20 or 30,000 CDs.
Isn't it funny when people think
if they don't sell, they can return.
Right, right. Isn't it funny when people think this industry is predicated on the merits of your music?
Like, no.
Yeah.
No. Josh, Josh, for you, was it like a very similar deal or was it kind of a different context?
It was different, but similar. I mean, the ending was the same.
Right.
I mean, we both stopped and started fresh with a new label. But I mean, it's crazy. Like thinking back now, the difference between the mid-2000s and the late-2000s, just in, just like what Carl was saying, just in like the amount of records we were shipping and selling and, you know, but so in the mid-2000s, you know, I had numerous bands selling 100,000 records and we were shipping hundreds and hundreds of thousands of CDs. And then in 2007, I switched from Sony to Universal, and Universal paid a fuck ton of money for me to move over there. And they thought that they would make all that money back on all the sales from what they saw from the last couple of years. And of course, that didn't happen. None of those records ended up selling what everyone thought they would. And then, you know, Universal took probably 500,000 returns.
Wow.
When retail decided that they wanted to not
have, that's a good point because
not have
when
CDs
retail
anymore.
Wanted to start returning, they all of a sudden, they would return so much at once that it's like, all right, we're going to release records for the next year just to break even on how upside down we are because they just returned
When I say 500,000 returns, I'm not exaggerating.
That's crazy.
Yeah. We literally got over 500,000. Most of them were destroyed because there's just nothing that could be done with them. Of course, the distributor charges you to destroy them. That's fun.
Wow. Jesus.
Oh yeah, dude. I remember sitting at my desk when we had the office in Princeton, pulling the trigger on paying someone
thousands of dollars to destroy CDs. Dude,
it wasn't thousands. It was more than because, and Benny, you'll appreciate this because you're a fucking hippie. Like I paid like 2 cents a unit extra to quote unquote recycle them instead of destroy them.
Goodness.
And I was like, all right, so this is me saving the planet. You know, those things went in a fucking
They did.
Yeah.
But I paid more to recycle them and it was 300,000 CDs.
Oh my God.
That I just paid to be quote unquote recycled.
So between the two of you, you had to destroy 800,000 CDs.
Oh, way more.
Way more than that, for sure.
God. That is so astonishing.
That's just two instances.
So that's astonishing.
If you think about, that's just Trustkill and Ferret. Think about,
Yeah.
Think about like Metal Blade and Epitaph and Victory and like.
Dude, Victory easily.
Millions.
Remember that Hawthorne Heights record that came out? Yeah. It shipped gold. I mean, didn't it ship platinum or something?
I think it did.
It shipped fucking something insane.
Yeah.
And Benny, that means shipped is like the number how many you ship.
Right.
Because if you, you know, like, so not it ships. Sell. And back then they kind of counted those as sales.
Right.
And it was like this insane amount of units. Oh, and then it had its first week. And it was like less than 10% of what they shipped.
Oh my goodness.
And all that shit came
all
back.
All that shit
and
came back. Everything came back.
All got burned.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I'm a little disappointed we didn't have some kind of, I mean, Josh, you had the space for it. We could have burned these, you know?
Oh, dude. Trust me.
We did that.
I took so many CDs back and so many records and so much dumb shit thinking like, oh, I could sell this eventually. Like,
Right.
No, because that was in the 80s. They had cutout bins. We missed that. That might have been in the early 90s before we really knew what we were doing.
Mm.
But because I remember the Roadrunner guys telling me, like, when you had a record, like, oh, we made 500,000 of these and we sold 15. What are we going to do with them? Oh, you sell them to these places called cutout bins where they'll give you like 50 cents a CD and they all end up in Mexico or some shit like that. But like, you know, in hindsight, that ruled because we were actually paying that much to destroy them as opposed to getting paid for it.
Yeah.
But no, when I closed my last office before, you know, when Good Fight changed up how we're doing
things. You called me up and I came over.
Yeah, Josh came over. I had an industrial sized dumpster and
we
me
just
and him were like
boxes of CDs.
We're just throwing CDs in a dumpster.
Trying not to tear up.
Yeah, exactly.
Was that, since it was the two of you in it, was it kind of like a cathartic, like,
it
all
was,
right,
cause
this
it was,
era cause is over and now like, a new one is starting?
Yeah, it actually, it felt kind of good. This was like 2010.
Yeah, it was 2012. It was 2012. I remember pretty vividly.
Oh, okay.
That's when I retooled how we did Good Fight.
Yeah.
And took it back over as just mine.
And we were crazy. Yeah, like filling up dumpsters with the CDs, but I'm like, man, maybe like digital will catch on.
Yeah,
right.
Who knows? This streaming shit could be cool.
That's wild, man.
But
I didn't know that.
I remember, what was the last Bamboozle at Giant Stadium parking lot? What year?
I think it was just the last one. I don't remember what
year
was
that.
Like, that was the one we played.
Like 2007, I want to say. So
probably around that.
So whatever that year was,
it was a good show.
Oh, it was amazing. But I remember that was when I had first started taking back like thousands of CDs. And I was like, yeah, I'll take back a couple thousand. I'll pass them out at fests. That'll be cool. So I'm standing outside of Bamboozle passing out CDs, like literally like free full length album CDs to people. And kids would grab them and just throw them on the floor.
Yeah. And you're just like,
and I was like,
awesome.
What the fuck am I doing with my life? Like, why, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Like no one cares.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
No one even wanted a free fucking CD.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, well, so how am I? Yeah. We definitely both had that moment. We're like, well, what the fuck are we going to do? Like, we got to go sell these things that, you know, people are having trouble giving away.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
like there was that weird period where really like when iTunes and digital downloads went away and CD, you know, and then following it, CDs went away. Like there was that period where it was like, fuck, this streaming thing it's going to be tricky because basically no one's making any money.
Right.
You know, and then I don't know, streaming got different and better.
I heard it's a thing now.
It's sort of a thing. Yeah.
I mean, it's not as good as it should be, but it's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, if you're still here, like, you know, me and Josh and everybody else that is still here, you've adapted and made it work.
Right.
You know, you kind of change how your business is.
Yeah.
And then the advent of vinyl.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of changed
everything. Vinyl's the greatest because it's non-returnable. What? The music industry fucked up.
One-way sales.
Fucked up so bad by allowing CDs to be returned. That was the fuck up.
Oh
yeah.
Yeah. Huh. What started that? Who was like the first domino for that?
I don't know. We should go fight them.
Yeah. Cause I mean, it was always that way when we were there.
Right.
Like I still remember the first person explaining it to me, be like, oh no, they can just send this back to you and you have to pay them back. And I was like,
but
why? They bought it. And they were like, yeah, no, this is just the deal. And I was like, okay. But like, if you sell, you know, if you sell Hot Topic, a bunch of t-shirts, that's a one way sale.
Right.
So that's why. You know, you'll see those.
That's bizarre.
Dude, even you know, like fanzines and like magazines you sell to Barnes and Noble. That's one way.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. That's why you see like Barnes and Noble when they can't sell something, you know, you can go out back because we used to be punk rock kids and we would do this and you go out by the dumpsters if you want to get free magazines and they just all have the covers torn off so you can't resell them.
You know, it's funny. There's one industry that works similarly because I used to have to do it was newspapers. When I used to work at like delis and stuff when I was a kid, if you know, the leftover newspapers of the day, you had to cut the top strip off.
Yeah, because that's where the that's how they could scan it or
right, whatever. And save them all, and then they would credit you back money for the extra newspapers. That was like a thing back in that day. Back in that day.
Back in my day.
Carl, the bass player from Nickelback is Chad's brother, Mike.
Yes. Yeah, they're brothers. I forgot his name was Mike.
There's
but yeah,
three Krogers in this band. I didn't know that.
I don't. Who's the third?
Oh, it said the original was a cousin, Brandon Kroger, as well.
He's bummed, huh?
When they were
should have held on.
When they were covering Led Zeppelin and Metallica songs as Village Idiot. That was their first.
Yeah, game. I remember the two. And I know the drummer that was around when I was working with them isn't in the band anymore. But I do remember there was like a funny thing. They played a show in Philly and like the night afterwards.
Wow. Look at this. It says Chad Kroger asked his stepfather to give him $4,000 so the band could record their first demo, a 7-track EP. That's a lot for a first demo. He said the band spent half the money to record and spent the other half on magic mushrooms. Did Nickelback get down like that? Were they?
Wow. Not when I was with them.
Not when you were with them?
But do you think that's a real thing, or is that somebody going back being like, oh, we got to come up with a cool
Listen,
story?
Listen, I'm on Wikipedia right now where...
No, that's and you know it's true.
At one point, my Wikipedia page was just Sidney Poitier's bio. So I don't necessarily believe it. No.
Yes, we can't necessarily count on it. No, I don't think so. True. Yeah.
But anyway, I brought up Rick, and not for embarrassing stories, but... I asked Rick's top three records from Ferret and Trustkill. But I want to hear, are you guys...
If we can guess them?
Yeah, I want to see if you can guess Rick's favorites. Because for anybody not listening to this, Rick...
That's a good question.
Rick is like, what is he of Ferret Records? Like the Prince?
I mean, Rick was my first employee and to this day...
The Duke?
You know,
the
like
Arch
he still
Duke?
Works with Goodfellas. I mean, yeah, yeah. I mean... All my kids call him Uncle Rick. I mean, you know, like he's...
I call him Uncle
he's
Rick.
He's my baby's godfather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's gotten me... And Carl's my other godfather.
Other one. Rick's definitely saved me from multiple beatings over the years on tour that I probably deserve.
I've even managed to get into that.
That's
I
true.
I saved you
that's
from
true.
A couple beatings myself.
Wait, did Rick like any Trustkill record?
Rick,
I mean, I obviously anything Poison the Well did.
So,
true story. Rick sang for Poison the Well once.
He did.
And I, to this day, I cannot find video of it, but I almost positive.
I just asked him recently if there's photo evidence, and he said yes, but he won't send it to me.
Wait,
yeah, I saw it once. I know I've seen it, but I don't have it.
Wait, while this is fresh on my mind, Josh, I have a memory in my head that I never knew if it was a wives' tale or not.
Okay.
I remember something from back in the day where Poison Oil needed to go on tour. They wouldn't.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Did you call?
I want to know what it is.
I think, did you?
I'm sure I know.
From my memory, you either threatened to or did call the Best Buy Jeffrey worked at to try to get him fired?
No, that is insane. I thought you meant one time I had to like, pay someone's rent or something like his mom or something. I don't know, something weird happened and they were like, we can't go on tour until this is paid. And I'm like, all right, here, like whatever it is. But
okay.
Oh, you do that. Dude, I pay bands heating bills and electricity bills.
Like,
and
someone's mom needed
pay that
rent
shit
paid. And
all
I'm like,
the time.
All right, yeah, mom, right. Here's the rent check.
That's your mom. Can you go on tour now?
Okay. But
Best Buy thing is that's a wives tale. I don't know
a
where
wives tale. Yeah. Okay. I think the other one that might be my fault, but I made a joke on the Trustkill website once that Jeff had just learned English.
Oh God.
Like right
asshole.
Before Opposite of December came out. And then like that kind of like took a
mildly racist turn.
Yeah. Yeah. Not great. Not great. I'll still always give Jeff credit. He is the one who taught me how to make an apple bowl. And That has been just absolutely invaluable through the years, that skill.
I still remember when Nora and Poison the Well were touring, and back, you know, we were all tight. So like every time we would stop at a gas station, it would just be a different mix of us in the van. Right. So we wouldn't even go back band to band. It would just be like whoever was hanging out would just switch bands. And I remember like getting in their van and he had the Apple bong thing going on. And I was like, dude, are you gonna, you're about to drive. And he's like, yeah, dog, it's all right. And I was like, all right, I'm going back to the Norvamp.
Oh, you fucking prude.
I think I know the three for Trustkill. Carl, you want to go first?
For Trustkill?
Well, no. But I mean,
you do Ferry. Josh does Trustkill.
It would be so much easier to go through the ferret records that Rick hates the most.
that would be easy too.
I would like that top three as well.
That he liked the most that Rick.
All right, for Trustkill, okay. I'm going to say Poison the Well, Opposite of December.
Uh huh.
Nora, Loser's Intuition.
Mm hmm.
And Harvest, Living with a God Complex.
You're close. Yeah, that's probably accurate. So you got two of the three bands.
Oh,
but
shit.
But he has Poison the Well, Tear from the Red.
Oh, well, of course, because it's got Carsey Street on it.
Right, exactly.
that's true.
Two, Throwdown, Haymaker.
Oh, shit. All right.
And three was Never Ending You Line by Nora.
Oh.
Stop it.
Stop it. I mean, not my favorite Nora, but I'm just saying.
All right, so Ferret Records would have been Disembodied If God Only Knew.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Fuck, all right. Now I got to figure out the rest of these. that one jumped out, and I'm like, what else did I put out? You go back.
That Rick actually liked.
Yeah, right? I don't want to, you know, silence on a podcast. It's just, you know, it's bad.
It builds suspense.
Converge, Petitioning the Empty Sky.
Okay.
And Torn Apart, self-titled.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I mean, great records, but no. He did. Number one was Disembodied, If God Only Knew. He said number two, The Bronx.
Oh, that's right. Fuck,
and number three, Remembering Never, God Save Us.
Oh, God shit. Save Us. Deep cut.
Yeah. And that's a good record.
Yeah. So those were, what are his bottom three? X5, Low End Theory.
I don't want to say that because he's friends with some of those bands. So I don't want to fucking bring it up.
Yeah.
I will say that like one of my favorite moments was when I was signing From Autumn to Ashes and we were talking about it. And I was like, dude, this band is awesome. We had like their demo and we had just gone out to Long Island to see them. And that's, you know, after like a band, if I'm going to drive all the way fucking Long Island and we were driving home afterwards and he was like, I don't know, dude, it fucking sounds like Iron Maiden with mosh parts. And I was like, I know, that's exactly why it's so great.
That's awesome. I asked the same thing from Ross, but he just gave me like a ton of bands. He's like, Torn Apart, For the Love of, Throwdown, Nora. But of course, my favorite one's Nora.
I mean, he wore the Throwdown hoodie at his own wedding. So, you know.
Oh my God, that's too funny.
That's true. Yeah, Benny, you did a bunch of tours with us.
Yeah, a ton. Yeah, I was
doing Travelers with us.
I was your roadie,
which was always awesome.
Someone was just asking about that the other day. They're like, you were a roadie? I'm like, ask Carl Severson how I was. So I'm like, how was I as a roadie?
You were great. You actually, as soon as you stopped doing it, they made me learn how to set up the drums. It was terrible.
I remember Ross would just send me out with you in Portland.
And just make sure these idiots get back.
Yeah, make sure they get. I'm like, you know, I'm like 6 years younger than both of them, right? Like, and I'm going to need Carl's black card to get us out of trouble anyway. The black card.
It was fun.
We needed that.
Yeah, that's gone.
We needed that.
Smarter days.
Yeah. Yeah, let's tell the people the real reason you had to shut it down, Carl. It was the black card.
that's what happened to Ferret.
Yeah, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. You just you James Hardened it. Too many nights.
Yeah.
But so I want to ask you guys this because, you know, as we've told the story, you are you put out a ton of like seminal hardcore metal records, ones that are going to be around forever, and bands that, you know, broke, and you obviously had just a really good ear and an eye for the bands that were going to be successful in this world. And like, after all these years involved in heavy music, there's two questions. What is it exactly that heavy music does for people? And what are the necessary elements to like make it effective?
I feel like it's completely, and this is going to be me saying get off my lawn sort of thing. Like, I feel like it's just totally different now than when we came up. Mm-hmm. Like we were talking about earlier, when I met Josh and Kyle and Mike, like, this was a time when I didn't have friends and was like, holy shit, I have friends. And then we actually started doing something and we were a part of, you know, this, and it was like a counterculture, and it was cool. And I don't necessarily know if people get that same sort of thing out of it now. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I mean, I'm 46, you know, so who am I to say what, you know, a 16-year-old kid gets about it, right, you know, gets out of it. But like, you know, I'm in a weird spot where, you know, my oldest son has really, really, really dove into this type of music. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, he grew up, you know, with me dragging him to shows and you know, I think since he was like 7 or 8, I've been, you know, taking him to shows and stuff like that.
Putting him in a Gaslight, you know, like, video.
That's right.
That's right. He was, yes, exactly. For all your listeners, yeah. My son, if you Carl. Go to, Benny, was that your first video? First Gaslight video?
No, it wasn't.
No, but it was the video for the 59 Sound, yeah. The little cute kid in it. Yeah. He's mine now, and he's also, now he's 6'7".
He's huge. Yeah. couldn't fit him in the wagon these days, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, he's deep into it now, and you know, and he loves it. And we talk every day about it, and he's always sending me music and I'm sending him stuff, and it's all that. And you know, but I just gotta assume that people can't get it the way we necessarily got it back then. I mean, for me, I didn't have anything else. I wasn't gonna play sports. I didn't make friends anywhere else. Like, you know, it was like skateboarding and punk and hardcore kind of just all went together and just grew into that. I mean, that turned into my whole, like, not only like, you know, any semblance of a social life I had, but like my friend group and how I grew up there. And right. Then, you know, like, you know, eventually like my career and, you know, and I still, all those same people, that's who I spend all my time with, you know, like, so I don't know. I mean, but yeah, the heavy music thing. Yeah, it's heavy and it wasn't all heavy. I mean, would you call Still Life heavy? They're one of the best bands ever. The double LP, fucking untouchable, you know, Ashes, you know, like that sort of stuff, you know, when you go through. So I feel like it's, some of it was just like coming through that whole community aspect of it.
Right.
Sort of thing.
I see. So more came from that. What about you, Josh? Yeah. What do you think like heavy music does for people, and what are like the necessary tools to make heavy music good?
I think you just, it's got to have emotion. I mean, it's weird to use the word emotion because that's where the word emo came from.
Right.
But heavy music at the end of the day is an outlet to express your angst and your rage and your, you know, whatever you're pissed off at. And that's all emotional. And, you know, like Carl said, like hardcore to us was emotional, whether it was Still Life or Chain of Strength or Marauder. They all sound different, but they're all emotional, and they kind of, I don't know, they elicit feelings that other music doesn't.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting because people think that heavy music has to come from like sheer force. But it's
that's not a thing. I don't think we never were like, oh my God, it's like, you know, angry. I mean, yeah, we were kids and we liked to mosh and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And, you know, but it wasn't like, I mean, and sure, there were people back then and there's people now that are like, just, you know, want to go and fight and all that. Like,
sure.
I don't know. I mean, I can count on the one hand how many fights I've gotten into at shows, and like, it was never when I was younger, you know?
Right.
you know, that's never what we were doing. We just, you know, for us, it was just like, it was just what we liked. And but I remember I was sitting like, you know, scour over lyrics and, you know, read them and learn them and stuff like that. And I want to find out about the bands. And that was back before you could fucking Google them, right. You know? So like, you know, I'd fucking write letters. Fucking true story. I wrote Lifetime their first piece of fan mail ever.
Did you really?
I did. And Ari wrote me back.
No way.
Do I got it in the box somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, somewhere.
That's but yeah, awesome. I wrote them their first piece of fan mail ever, which is, you know, embarrassing, but kind of awesome.
No, that's kind of awesome.
Not for nothing. I mean, you know, like fucking everything that band put out, I absolutely love.
Sure, sure. So the last thing before we get out of here is just like, you know, you're both family people now, have been for a while. What are the types of like things from your journey, you know, about, you know, alternative music and culture that you've brought into like your family life, and how do you balance the question authority level of punk rock while having your children listen to your authority?
It's interesting. I mean, I guess Josh and I have different perspectives on it because my kids are older than his. Yeah. So like I've, you know, he'll deal with, and I've got both boys and his oldest is a girl. Mm-hmm. So, but like, you know, with my kids, like one of the things, like, you know, I started early on, like, you know, playing music for them whenever we're going and trying to like, you know, like expose them to music. But like, you know, a lot of music, there's bad words in and, you know, that sort of stuff, you know, swearing and all that. And like, and I grew up in addition to hardcore, you know, me and Josh, we listened to like tons of hip hop and stuff like that. And, you know, and I've kind of always been of the mind and remember, you know, I mean, this is well over a decade ago now, probably 15 years ago now, you know, with my oldest being like, you know, like, yeah, like I'm not going to, you can listen to anything. I don't, you know, you want to listen to Eminem. I don't care what they're saying. I mean, listen to it, you know, if,
right.
if you think it's interesting, you know, like I'm not going to censor any sort of music because, you know, that never happened to me.
Sure.
And yeah. And, you know, I want you to grow up to be smart enough that if you're like, oh, this is like misogynistic, you know, trash, or this is just culturally irrelevant, or is it just, you know, like just sucks,
sure.
or if it's just swearing and being crazy for the sake of being crazy. But like, I want you to see past that as well,
huh.
you know, but at the same time, you know, a lot of times they use that to emphasize points in music and stuff like that. And that's, you know, like, and I want you to get that out of it as well. Hmm. You know, I've wanted him, you know, both my kids to like really get into music and appreciate it and actually listen to it, what people are saying. And, you know, but outside of that, as far as, you know, like, other aspects of life, you know, I mean, they see how I work and I'm sure Josh's kids are going to grow up seeing the same way he works. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, neither of us are putting on suits and ties and,
right.
you know, coming home utterly fucking miserable and, right. you know, hating our jobs and stuff.
Sure.
Like, you know, we kind of lived the dream. Like
yeah.
we had hobbies and that's what we ended up doing with our lives. And, you know, like we're like actual proof that that's possible,
yes.
you know?
Yes.
And it's not something that you just fucking slip into.
Like, nah,
the shit
right.
was hard.
Yeah,
I think. I think what we can learn from me and you, and what I want to teach my kids, is just pave your own path. Mm. You know, like,
yeah,
don't think that the options that are out there are your only options. Like, if there's something you love that you want to do, just go fucking do it. Make it happen.
I love that. That's like the classic punk rock spirit, right there. Right.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, Carl and I loved hardcore. We had bands that we loved and we wanted the whole world to hear them. And so we did it.
I love it.
Yeah. And we're, you know, we work with and are friends with other people that like came through same sort of stuff we did, you know, or, you know, even like, or, you know, much harder. I mean, I'm not going to say my upbringing was hard at all. You know, like my parents were super good to me, but you know, we know a number of people in music that have gone on to be super successful, more successful than us that, you know, had the same thing. They just found something they loved and they just hustled for it and made it work.
That's through it.
Work, you know, and just you push for it and you fight for it. And there's a ton of people out there that's been, you know, super impressive. And then, you know, at the same time, like, you know, as we get older and you meet people outside of music, we call them citizens, kind of as a joke.
But right,
like,
right.
you know, when you meet them and you're like, oh, this dude may have, you know, make a bag of money. I don't know if he's a fucking software engineer or something like that. But like, you look at it and you're like, I don't want that life, man. You know,
yeah.
if it meant more money, it's still like, eh. you know, like that's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, like you gotta be happy with what you're doing. Like there's nothing wrong with working, but if you hate every single second of it, you know, it's not worth it. You just got to figure it out.
Fuck yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, I don't want to, you know, I would never impress upon anybody that like, oh, if you don't like what you're doing, don't do it. They're like, no, like, you know, I've always said this, the best time to look for a new job is while you are gainfully and fucking employed, you know,
right.
Like,
yeah,
you know, don't wait till you're fucked and have no money. Cause then you need to do anything.
Yeah,
when you're doing something, even if you don't like it, keep doing it, deal with it and figure out your exit strategy.
Yeah. Try not to bottom out. Cause it's fucking hard to get up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah, a lot of people are just like, oh, that guy, fuck, I don't want to do this. So I'm not going to do it. Be like, well, you know, you're going to get fucking cold and hungry.
100%. So. Yeah, that is wise. Well, gentlemen, thanks for hanging out for this long. I appreciate it. And also thank you both for not only putting out some of my favorite records of all time, but both being uniquely cool to me over the years and helping me out and giving me shows. And, you know, you guys are part of the path that I went on. You talk to other people and, you know, you guys helped me get there. So I appreciate it. And yeah, I love you both.
Nice.
Absolutely. Love you too.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Love you too, buddy.
Oh, Brad.
Oh, Benny.
Taking a stroll down memory lane. What if you were 16 years old and you could have put a band out? Who, like, what kind of label would you have had?
Oh, definitely punk rock label, like full on, you know. I mean, at 16, what, like what I was listening to at 16? Or like,
who was the
local
band?
If I was a 16-year-old now, what would I put out? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm asking when you were 16 in your weird town.
Yeah.
Who was the band you would have put out if you were like, I'm going to throw a record out?
I don't know. I mean, when I was 16, I was barely starting to get into punk rock. I was so sheltered. I was listening to like fucking, what was I listening to? Like fucking Blue Oyster Cult.
still at 16, you're on Don't Fear the Reapers.
I think so. I mean, I was getting into the Clash. Maybe I wasn't listening to that. You know what I was listening to? So growing up in Massachusetts, of course, the fucking Cars were like huge.
Oh.
So I was listening. The Cars were definitely all over the place. And I was definitely starting to get into that sound of like the crossover punk pop new wave, whatever the fuck it was called. It definitely would have been something like that. I mean, I was writing songs like that too.
So. And I'm sure at some point as a producer, engineer, you have conceived the idea of owning your own record label and recording all the bands, right?
Benny, I have a record label. I do have a record label.
See, I called it so bad. Did I even know that? You have a record label too?
Yeah, I don't really promote it because it's kind of a vanity deal.
What's your latest release?
My latest release is The Reply, which is a ska band from the 80s that were all high school. Speaking of 16-year-olds, it's a really good record and it's good ska. And it happens to have my wife's brother in it.
Nice.
But that's essentially, so I started the label like maybe 10 or 11 years ago because I was producing. There's this band called Amenity from San Diego, which was a hardcore band that was part of, that was pretty big in the scene back in the 90s, early 90s, mm-hmm. I guess. I mean, Zach De La Roca had something to do with the band. I don't think he was actually in the band, but he came, it was part of that. He came out of the scene that they were spawned from. They were a big band in Southern California. Anyway, they did a reunion show like 10 or 12 years ago, and they got together and recorded a single, which I mixed. And then I had had a friend at Orchard Distribution, which is a digital distribution label, who was like, dude, if you ever want, you know, I'll hook you up. I'll give you like a, he gave me a pretty sweet deal to like, he's like, if you ever want to have your own label. So I was like, actually, I've got this band that doesn't know what to do with their digital release. So
Is this the reply that has a Discord release?
Yeah. The vinyl's on Discord.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I see this. It's a two LP collection. So you put this out digitally.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Look at you. So you're the digital arm of Discord Records, and I didn't even know that.
It's the opposite. They put out the vinyl. Yeah, the Reply's a fun, I gotta say, they're a fun band. I'm not just saying that because my brother-in-law was in the band.
That's cool.
They sound cool. They're very like Jam. They sound more like the Jam than like ska to me.
You know, it's funny, all the bullshit you talk where I'm like, what is Brad even talking about sometimes? And then you just lay this out that you're a record label owner. I'd have been sending you demos, guy.
You know, I'm screwed. I'm going to get fucking, going to get sent to, it's literally everybody on there is like, I have a personal connection to, or it's like my own bands. Like I'm going to start, release of
I
stuff.
Think I'm going to start forwarding you requests.
No. I literally have a one page contract.
Demo submissions.
I basically have a one page contract that says I pretty much guarantee that I will not ever pay you anything.
Well, that's a great contract.
It's like, I mean, streaming revenue is so tiny that, you know, it says in my contract, if you don't break $20 a year, I'm not going to pay you. That's what it says. If you don't make more than 20 bucks a year in streaming, I'm not going to pay you because it's just, it's not worth writing a fucking check and doing the paperwork. Right, and I send all the, like, you know, I send the reports out to all the bands.
So you did your reporting.
Yeah, I do. I do year end. And sometimes, like, if somebody's like kind of charting and it looks like they must be on some playlists or something, I'll shoot out the charts to them.
Well, I got to say, the way you present yourself makes more sense now.
Why?
Well, because label owners are the type of guys, you know, who wear like pastel little shorts, boating shoes, sunglasses on their head. The whole deal.
I've never worn my sunglasses on my head, even when I was that fucking 16-year-old douchebag.
If you were listening to BOC, I don't think you were too big of a douchebag. At least probably meant you were smoking some pot or something.
They were definitely like my middle school band.
Nice. Have you ever seen that film, The Stoned Age?
No.
Where the guy gets real high at a Blue Oyster Cult show and it's trapped in a bubble and floats across the audience.
No, that sounds fantastic.
It's real fun.
I'll check it out.
So let's clip this intro since we're
about to record.
Our guests are waiting for us right now. Hit us with the socials. Let's get out of here.
Yeah, so at Bullettooth Records HQ and at Goodfight Music, you can catch those guys. They also have personal accounts at Josh Grabel and at Carl Goodfight. As always, you can catch up with us at goingofftrack.com. You can go to patreon.com/goingofftrack and become a patron and get in on, you know, some special incentives like our Thursday night chat, which I think we're going to be a little late to tonight, maybe. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we'll make it. Be our friends.
You can give us reviews on Apple Music, wherever else you get your podcasts from. Rate the podcast if you like it. And
yeah, only if you like it.
Yeah. And I guess we'll see you next week.
Yeah.